From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Doping scandals are not new to sports around the world. Here in the U.S., think Lance Armstrong. But something big happened this week in the world of international sports. An explosive new report says the government of Russia has been running a huge operation to dope its track and field athletes and to hide the evidence. It could cost Russia its place in next summer's Olympic Games in Rio. This hour on Point, the Russian doping scandal. Joining me first this hour from New York City is Wall Street Journal's senior special writer on sports, Matthew Futterman. He's been covering doping scandals in the sports world for many years and is certainly paying close attention to this one. His recent story in the journal is titled Why the Anti-Doping Effort Needs an Overhaul. And you'll find a link on our website, onpointradio.org. Matt, welcome. Good to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jane.
So let me play here sound. Here's Dick Pound, commission chairman and former president of World Anti-Doping Agency, speaking at a press conference on Monday. He led this investigation into widespread doping in Russian athletics and said this wasn't about individual coaches or athletes cheating. It was the Russian government itself.
All of this could not have happened and continue to happen without the knowledge of and either actual or implied consent of the state authorities. They were not operating sport, but as I say, they would certainly have known.
Implied consent of the state authorities. Matt, help us understand the scope of this.
Well, the scope is pretty big. It's sort of as big as it gets when it comes to doping, because we're not talking about something like Lance Armstrong, which was a group of cyclists, generally private. Maybe the U.S. cycling authorities might have been sort of looking the other way for a while and, you know, moderately complicit in terms of those actions, you know, but this would be, you know, everyone from athletes, coaches, scientists who are running the anti-doping lab, the sports ministries who are in charge of the sports but not supposed to be in charge of the anti-doping labs but essentially are, and rising on up through the government. So that you have what has come to be known as a state-sponsored doping program.
And so who conducted this independent inquiry?
So what happened was you had a Russian runner, and her husband happened to be a doping control officer, and they were the whistleblowers. And they apparently reported some of these indiscretions to anti-doping authorities and didn't get much action on that. And when they got frustrated, they went to a German news organization who put together a really terrific documentary last year that aired. And then after that was made public, there was so much public pressure. The World Anti-Doping Agency had no choice but to investigate what exactly was going on and what the connections were between runners, coaches, Russian anti-doping authorities, and what now we see was also the World Track and Field Federation, known as the IAAF.
Let me play part of that documentary. Here it is on Germany's ARD network. Started this whole scandal, as you say. Here you can hear German voices played over secretly recorded tapes of top Russian coaches and athletes talking about doping.
Das sind verbotene Substanzen?
Sag das nicht so. Nenn das eine spezielle Art der Vorbereitung. Spezialvorbereitung.
The translation here, they are banned substances? Don't say that. Call them a special kind of preparation, a special preparation. That's how it will go in winter. End quote. So, Matt Futterman, a large part of this report, this 300-page report that stemmed from that documentary, centers on a laboratory in Moscow which processed the blood and urine samples of Russian athletes. What are the allegations surrounding that lab?
Well, what I think is most interesting is that there are actually two labs in Moscow.
Okay.
So there was one lab which screened the samples, and I think we're mainly talking about blood and urine samples here, that screened the samples, and the ones that were dirty, you know, got hidden, and the ones that were clean got sent to the other lab, which was the supposedly the established and sanctioned lab, which, you know, obviously you're not supposed to have two labs, one screening samples and, you know, one, you know, supposedly quote-unquote, testing them.
Right.
So that's really what – that's one of the things that was going on. It sort of reminds you of that scene at the end of Bananas when, Woody Allen's talking about the mockery of the sham. That's sort of what we're talking about here.
The report also alleges that Russia's Secret Service agents intimidated workers at a drug testing lab to cover up top athletes' positive drug test results. And they impersonated lab engineers during the Winter Olympics in Sochi last year. What happened there?
Yeah, this is something you hear, you heard about ever since the Sochi Games ended, that there were some people who were in the anti-doping lab in Sochi who were not really supposed to be there. And as it turns out, they were members of the Russian security force, what we formerly used to call the KGB, that is now called the FSB. And some of this was in the WADA report. WADA does a report on the anti-doping operations at each games.
WADA is the World Anti-Doping Agency.
Sorry, the World Anti-Doping Agency. They're based in Montreal. They're founded in 1999. They're supposed to oversee education, research, and to some extent testing, but they don't have enough money to actually do that. Anyway, but they have an independent observer team at the Olympics, evaluating the lab and the work that's going on there, because the lab is actually usually run by the host country. That's the way it's supposed to work. They noted in their report that there were these FSB officials, and it was unclear exactly what those FSB officials were doing, but they were there. And as it turns out, it seems like, according to this report, there was a pretty intense supervision of the anti-doping process and updates that were going to Russian state security.
Intense supervision, if not control, of the doping lab, apparently. Let's take this to Moscow for a moment. Joining me from the Russian capital is Natalia Antonova. She's a writer, journalist, and playwright, former editor of the Moscow News. She contributes to The Guardian, Mashable, and Open Democracy. Natalia, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Jane.
So how are Russians reacting to this story?
As Russians are wont to do, if they care at all, then they are reacting extremely negatively. And there is no real soul searching going on in Russia on this subject. I would say that most people think it's a kind of plot to once again demean, demoralize, humiliate Russia. I mean, people are not taking this very well at all.
Here's a press conference from Monday where the Russian minister of sports pushed back at the allegations that his government had an institutionalized system of doping Russian athletes, basically calling the report a smear campaign. This is an attempt, he says, made to cast a shadow all over Russian sport. It is unacceptable, and I can assure you that Russian sport is today one of the leaders of the world sport, and it is both fighting doping and taking part in competitions, and we will continue this work, end quote. Natalia, if everybody's so cynical about this and defensive even, what's going on in the minds of that Russian whistleblower, that Russian runner and her husband, taking down the system, essentially?
Well, the thing is, I don't think they've taken anything down yet, unfortunately. Mm. Sport in Russia, it's got nothing to do with private initiatives. It's a prestige project. It's part of like the holy trinity of Russian prestige projects, the stuff that Russians bond over. You have the space program, you have winning World War II, and then you have sport. Mm. And the government, it takes sport very seriously. They know that it's one of the few things in Russia today that really brings the population together. It's something that Russians can bond over. So far, I wouldn't say they've taken anyone down. We haven't even seen anyone. I think maybe one person was possibly fired so far. It hasn't made much impact in Russia yet.
Sounds like the head of the Russian lab is out here at least first. We'll see if the sports minister goes or what happens next. But here's some more sound from Dick Pound at a Monday press conference. He said of the three-man commission that investigated this Russian doping scandal, said Russia may pay dearly come next summer's Olympics in Rio de Janeiro.
For 2016, our recommendation is that the Russian Federation be suspended. In fact, one of our hopes is that they will volunteer that so they can undertake the remedial work. If they don't, then it has to play itself out, and the outcome may be that there are no Russian track and field athletes in Rio.
There is some suggestion, Matt Futterman, that Russian athletes may be banned from the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro in 2016. Is that a real possibility?
I think it is to some extent real. I mean, it's going to be a bit of a hedge on my part. I think they're real in the threats, but they're also real in saying, in offering a series of things that Russia can do in order to avoid that. That's generally what the people in the Olympic movement do. They threaten this really, really nasty, harsh punishment. Usually that has to do with non-participation. But they say, if you take these steps, you can avoid this punishment. And, I think Russia will probably take some of the steps. They'll close down the lab. They'll probably open a new lab. They'll fire some of the cronies and apparatchiks, and they'll probably hire new cronies and apparatchiks. I mean, the Russians have been doing this for 50 years. As I should note, lots of other athletes and lots of other countries have been doing this for 50 years. In some other states, it has been state-sponsored or could continue to be state-sponsored. In other places like the U.S., it's very common, but it's done, it's done privately between, coaches and athletes and usually not with the blessing of the athletics.
Lots of other countries, athletes, you say, doing this as well. We'll talk about that after the break. We're speaking about this big new report from the World Anti-Doping Agency calling out Russia for a huge government-sanctioned program to dope its athletes to win more medals. You can join the conversation. Are people in Russia right to shrug it off and say, well, everybody does it? Should Russia be kicked out of next summer's Olympic Games in Rio? I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the problem of doping, steroids, growth hormones, and much more in international sports competition. And the news this week that the Russian government has been allegedly running a doping scheme and may be forced to sit out the next Olympics. You can join the conversation. Does this feel like just a throwback to the old Soviet days of steroid-filled athletes? My guest this hour, Natalia Antonova. She's in Moscow, former editor of the Moscow News. And we have Matt Futterman, the Wall Street Journal's senior special writer on sports in New York. Let's take a call here, Fernando, in Austin, Texas. Fernando, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, James.
Hello.
I do disagree with punishing Russia just because of that doping that came up to light. But what about all the countries that do it? And pretty much they do it on a normal way. Every time that they participate of Olympic Games, they have some of the athletes already on doping. So, no, I don't think that's fair.
All right, Fernando, thank you. It's a point you brought up earlier, Matt Futterman. Sort of everybody does it, lots of other countries at least. Some examples here in the United States. Here's one very public one in 2013. After being stripped of his 7 Tour de France wins, Lance Armstrong finally fessed up after years of allegations and suspicions on the Oprah Winfrey Show that he used performance-enhancing drugs.
Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Yes or no? Was one of those banned substances EPO?
Yes.
Did you ever blood dope or use blood transfusions to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
And in 2007, U.S. track star Marion Jones, winner of 3 gold medals and 2 bronze medals, admitted to lying under oath about her use of steroids prior to the 2000 Summer Olympics. She gave a tearful press conference and later served 6 months in prison.
I want you to know that I have been dishonest. And you have the right to be angry with me. I have let them down. I have let my country down. And I have let myself down.
Natalia Antonova, you heard our caller, Fernando. There are a couple of clips from problems in our past, certainly. You talk about this sort of everybody-does-it-ism in Russia, as you call it. How does that play into all this?
Well, you have to understand that recent polls show that the majority of Russians believe that if the government needs to lie in order to achieve its aims, and certainly winning is seen as this, once again, a state prestige project, then if they want to win, they might as well lie. I don't think that we're going to see any tearful press conferences in Russia anytime soon. Russians don't do tearful press conferences, especially not Russian officials. But in general, Russians just don't do them. And of course, part of the reason is the fact that there is this assumption and understanding that everybody does it, and the Russians will tell you, "Well, okay, we did it, we got caught, but that's only because we're not as good at cheating as some of the other parties are." But the other side of this is really the mentality that, you know, never apologize, never explain. That has been the staple of any Russian government for, you know, for hundreds of years. That hasn't changed. In fact, telling the truth about this, being open, you know, maybe crying a little bit at a press conference, it would make you look weak. And the worst thing you can do as a Russian official or a public figure or an athlete is to look weak. Russians don't do weakness very well. They consider it a problem.
Matt Futterman, this investigation focused mostly on track and field athletes. But by Russia's own admission, the Moscow labs in question also processed test results for as many as, I think, 20 other sports. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, these are labs that do cover other things, and they're also connected with other labs throughout the country. I mean, you talk about the Sochi lab during the Olympics. I think it's important also to realize that, you know, there is going to be some focus on the Sochi lab during the Olympics, and the IOC has said, oh, no, we've done our checks, that lab was fine. That lab may have been fine. I mean, the real benefits of doping don't happen during competition. They happen in the year or the years ahead of competition, because, you know, what doping really does is allows you to train harder, and that's what makes you stronger, far more than you know, taking something right before the gun goes off.
Matt, Natalia, hold on for a moment, because I'd like to bring a third voice into this conversation. John Hoberman joins me now from Austin, Texas. He's a sports historian and historian of the Olympic Games and a doping expert at the University of Texas, Austin. He's the author of Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping, and Mortal Engines, The Science of Performance and the Dehumanization of Sport. So as you can tell, he's a great expert to have on this hour. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So you've been doing this for a long time. More than 30 years. What do you make of this alleged state-sponsored doping in Russia?
This is a spectacular scandal on a scale that only equaled in the past by the East German state doping program that was understood only after the collapse of the East German state in 1989. I think the Russian scandal also has to be understood in an even larger context, and that is that what we are witnessing is the collapse of the moral authority of global sports governance. This has been happening, I mean, visibly to the world public over the past couple of years. In 2013, the International Cycling Federation of the UCI basically fell apart. Part of its problem was the Lance Armstrong scandal. The International Football Federation, FIFA, has been coming apart in spectacular fashion over the past year or two, and that is still in process. What we have now is the International Track and Field Federation coming apart as the immediate consequence of the revelations about the Russian track and field program. This is a third major international federation, all of them affiliated with the International Olympic Committee,
uh-huh.
The IOC. So this is a whole family. And the next one, I predict, is going to be the International Swimming Federation, FINA. I see no reason why they should not, in effect, fall victim to the same forces that have destroyed these three.
Let me ask you about that in a minute. But you mentioned the collapse of the moral authority of the sports governance around the world. You say FIFA and others that we've seen and heard about. Help us understand the structure here, because formally you have the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, at the helm, the sort of umbrella organization over a smaller number of these international governing bodies. How do they all work together?
They work together in that the IOC is sort of the statutory head of all this. But the major sports federations like the UCI and FIFA and IAAF and FINA and some others, these are basically fiefdoms. that are run by opportunistic people who have recruited themselves into the upper echelons of global sports government. This is and has been for a long time. It is an ethics-free zone where just about anything goes if you can get away with it. And one of the advantages of the spectacular FIFA scandal is that it has initiated the global public into this world in a big way, that finally the tip of this iceberg, in this case FIFA, is demonstrating the large numbers of really unscrupulous people who have taken charge of major global sports.
And as I understand it, the heads of all these international organizations, International Track and Field, International Cycling, FIFA, they all serve, someone from their organization serves on the board of the IOC, right?
They are all of the heads of these organizations are, in fact, members of the IOC.
There are certain of the international federations where the head of the federation does have an automatic seat on the IOC,
yeah.
But not all of the international federations have that seat. Sepp Blatter, who was the head of FIFA, was an IOC member. That's ending. I don't think the next president of FIFA automatically has a seat on.
That is correct. I was referring only to the major federations I mentioned.
The bottom line is they're all enmeshed at some point.
They're all enmeshed. And when you look at the last 10, 15 years of IF, that is to say International Federation officials, who have been mixed up in publicized financial or doping corruption, you see one current or recent IOC member after the next.
Let's get a call in here. Michael in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I was going to go a little bit broader.
Okay.
You guys were mentioning at the beginning of this section there's other countries doing it. Now, I can definitely understand why Russians feel defensive if you're not going after countries like North Korea and Kazakhstan and some of the Caucasus region countries, that especially in weightlifting and other strength-based disciplines have been at least implicated in doping, if never proven. Is there a way for the IOC, well, obviously apparently pretty corrupt, but is there a way for the IOC to kind of fight this stuff?
Michael, thank you. Matt Futterman, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a way to do it. It's sort of both easy and complicated at the same time. It's easy because, you know, to draw it up on paper, it's easy. And that's just to give the power of drug testing to an independent international third-party organization. The problem with, I mean, one of the problems with WADA is its president right now is a guy named Craig Reedy, who's a member of the IOC. Now, he's a perfectly nice guy, and but if something is going wrong with the drug testing at the IOC, and the guy in charge of the people who are supposed to enforce that is actually a member of the IOC, he certainly has an incentive to not go after the other organization that he's a member of as hard as someone who's completely independent might be. Now, whether he does that or not is another question. But on the face of it, people like you and me have every reason to be skeptical about his motives. So that's really, I think, what you need is, you need to create an organization or if you have an organization, you want to use WADA, just give them a lot more money than they're getting right now. Fund them so that they can actually run an international third-party doping or anti-doping organization.
Yeah.
The complication, though, is sending people across borders and into other countries. I've been to Russia a couple of times. you know, they have to approve you're going into the country. You have to, you know, you have to get invited. So the immigration people know immediately who's coming in, and then they can tip off, they can potentially tip off why they're there, you know, if it's going to be a state-sponsored thing.
Michael,
so it gets
thank
a little
you.
Complicated.
Yeah, Michael, thank you so much. How is it possible, Natalia Antonova, that the World Anti-Doping Agency allows national sports federations to police their own athletes? Seems like such a conflict of interest. Why isn't there a third-party independent testing system unless the whole system is just, frankly, corrupt?
Well, I think it goes back to the question of, you know, what is sports nowadays? I mean, is sports all about winning? Is it all about the commercial contracts? What is it about? I think that in a country like Russia, where once again, sports is very much a state-controlled type of thing. It's not even about money as much as it is about making your countrymen proud. And unfortunately, as we're seeing, how you make them proud, how you go about winning, it's really not the number one question. Not for the Russians. I mean, once again, I do want to. I mean, we've been talking about this being a global problem. It is very much a global problem, and the fact that Russia is on the defensive right now. I mean, it makes sense to me. It's not just politics. It's also just the fact that this is prevalent in the world in general. I mean, I've been seeing. I was reading up about this problem last night, and I haven't seen calls about what if doping is not going to go away, is there a way to potentially admit that, well, hey, everyone dopes, can we like legalize it like you legalize marijuana? I mean, I don't know, I'm not an expert on it, and based on the stuff that I've read about it, you have the problem of the athlete's health, of course, and what it does to people. So, I mean,
I
would want to talk about that.
Yeah, Natalia, thank you. John Hoberman, what do you make of that? There are some who say around the world, just legalize this, eliminate the cheating, the corruption, the cost, the effort of monitoring. You know, it's so widespread. Just make sure they do it safely.
That is delusional. There are several reasons why we do not want to legalize doping. One, as the colleague just pointed out, was all sorts of health effects on athletes that are going to be damaging. Second one is how much further do we want to corrupt the world of the sports physicians? There are many corrupt sports physicians who are doping enablers. Some of them are also medically incompetent. There are publicized cases of this. And do we really want to create an even larger cast of doctors who are doping enablers? And there's a third point, and that is a very practical question having to do with the attitudes of parents with athletically gifted children who will know in advance that if that child is put on the high-performance path, he or she is going to wind up in the hands of doping doctors. There's all sorts of reasons to reject legalization.
Let me get a call in here before the break. Scott, you're on the air from Detroit, Michigan. I got about a minute left. If you could be brief, thank you.
Well, thank you. I think this goes to the recent comments. I mean, if we can't, it seems to me that we can't police it absolutely. So why not acknowledge it and let the athletes make the decision as to whether they're going to destroy themselves and let it be a free-for-all.
Scott, thank you. Matt Futterman, you hear that over and over. You really do.
Yeah, you do hear that over and over. But I think the idea of sport, you got to protect the clean athletes, the people who want to do it the right way. I don't think that's sort of a dictatorial approach or, enforcing my morals on anybody else's. I think that's sort of common sense from a health standpoint, from a competition standpoint. Those are the people that you need to protect.
We are looking at big news in sports this week, discussing Russia's alleged national doping program and the problem of doping internationally. You can join the conversation. Do you think the story will spread beyond Russia? Has it already? How does the U.S. factor into this? I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break, including more of your calls. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at the big news in sports this week, Russia's alleged doping scandal, and you can join the conversation. My guest this hour, John Hoberman, sports historian and historian of the Olympic Games, and a doping expert at the University of Texas, Austin, Natalia Antonova in Moscow, former editor of the Moscow News, and Matt Futterman in New York, senior special writer on sports for the Wall Street Journal and author of the forthcoming book, Players, the Story of Sports and Money and the Visionaries Who Fought to Create the Revolution. Here's some sound from 2012 Summer Olympics in London. American middle distance runner Alicia Montoyo finished fifth in the 800-meter finals behind two Russian athletes who the World Anti-Doping Agency now claim are part of a widespread doping scandal. Without those two sprinters in the race, Montoyo would have received a bronze medal.
At the end of the day, they're thieves. You know, it's a criminal act. I would tell them all of the things that they stole from me that they cannot replace.
John Hoberman, what about the athletes who aren't doping and the difficulties for them?
This is the least heard group in the entire drama. From time to time, you see stories about principled athletes who have, as this young lady just pointed out, missed out on unique life moments where she should have been on the podium and cheaters were instead. The reform of doping, so-called, has to happen at two levels. We're always talking about the upper executive level, the sports administrations, and how you have to find honest people to do that. In a way, the harder part is to, in effect, do what's called anti-doping education. The World Anti-Doping Agency is very big on that. It requires it of its affiliates around the world. The problem is that you can't do anti-doping education just by interactive games like on the WADA website, et cetera. You really have to persuade people that this is not what sport is for, that there is such a way to create a level playing field where you need a community of athletes who agree that this is not the way they are going to do elite sport. Now, when the International Cycling Federation came apart in 2013, and by the end of that year, a reformist president from Britain had been elected in the place of the compromised people, there was real hope that this was an elite culture that could, in a sense, rejuvenate itself, that could transform itself. Mm. And interestingly, the results of this experiment, we are now 2 years into it, have been quite mixed. And the sad part is that there is still a great deal of suspicion and accusation and questions raised about these performances and those performances. This is a very difficult reform project because the economic and career incentives are just built into the system. When you take a person who has no economic prospects, and dramatic examples of this would come, say, from poor East African countries. Now Kenya has a brewing doping crisis that has been picking up steam for the last year or two. These are people who can transform their lives by winning one Grand Prix race in Europe during the summer. When you build in incentives like that, it is going to be very difficult to persuade critical mass of athletes on idealistic grounds that they should be performing drugs.
It's such a good point, John Hoberman. Thank you. Here's Dick Pound, actually, commission chairman and former president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, saying that under Russia's doping regime, athletes couldn't play fair even if they wanted to, not if they hoped to get ahead.
In many cases, it's part of a system where they have no practical choice. If they want to participate and have access to coaching, you follow the regime or you're out.
Matt Futterman, speak to John's point here. How do the incentives that are built into these high-performance sports create a system where the only practical way to operate is to cheat?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of it is built into the contracts with the shoe companies, which have bonuses for if you, the better you perform. So, you know, it's a financial incentive, and obviously the fame that goes with that. So, you know, that's not going to be any different whether you're, you know, growing up with nothing in Kenya or whether you're growing up, you know, on the North Shore of Chicago with a lot. You know, you can do, the better you do, the better you'll do financially. Now, having said that, I think, you know, the issue that you get to is it can all go away very, very quickly if you get caught. And if they can just get better at catching people, maybe people will realize that, you know, this might not all be worth it. Having said that, a lot of the people who do get caught still live in pretty nice houses, and I think Lance Armstrong, you know, no one's had to take up a collection for him.
A lot of listeners responding to this online. Matt, thank you for that. Wynn says, this is another excuse just to bash Russia. John says, just start another Olympics for athletes who want to dope. If everybody is doing it, why not allow it in a separate competition? The Extreme Olympics for dopers, so we know which games are full of doped up athletes and which games are not. Bet you dollars to donuts, the Extreme Olympics draw higher ratings. Half sarcasm there, John, but we hear the point. Let's go to Sarah in East Hampton, New York. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
So I was wondering, when you are an athlete in this situation, how much doping, you know, really changes the game? So you're saying that story about the sprinters, and you have the two sprinters that chose to dope, right? And then you have the one athlete that didn't place in the end. So what's kind of the bell curve, you know, doping once, doping twice, doping three times, that really gets these athletes over this edge? You know, like, so what are the tests show maybe in a lab for how much doping is needed to put you at that point where, you know, you are going to place, you're going to be a gold medalist? What are the choices that athletes face when it comes to amount of doping and then also what they're putting their bodies at risk for?
That's Sarah. Thank you so much. And also, Matt Futterman, how the athletes are getting around the system.
Well, I think to answer the first question, you know, the ballpark figure that you hear when you talk to scientists is about 10%, but you're talking about, you know, the difference between first place and 18th place may be 2%. So 10% is massive. That may not sound very massive, but it really is. It's the back, you know, it's the, you know, it's the back of the peloton, to, difference between the back of the peloton and the front of the peloton. That's the first question. The second question, how do they get around it? You know, there are all sorts of things. There are masking agents that people use, microdosing, which is, you know, lots of little small doses. That's what Alex Rodriguez was apparently using in the dugout in baseball. And in terms of the other way people get around it is they have, you know, they have people tipping them off as to when they get tested, you know, when they're going to get tested. I've been told that it takes about 3 hours to clear your body of any trace of a performance-enhancing drug. So that if you just get some notice, and I think that happens a lot, and I think that's where the international federations are complicit in this, you know, not just in, you know, things like the Olympics or world championships, but also in a lot in the pro circuits as well. You know, I think it's kind of absurd that that FIFA didn't catch one soccer player doping ahead of the World Cup or during the World Cup last year.
Right, not one.
Yeah, not one. I mean, it was 700, you know, the best soccer players in the world, and, you know, not one of them is taking anything. You know, tennis. Tennis is another one where they just almost never catch anyone. I think they have very little incentive to catch anyone, any of the big stars in tennis. There's only about five or six players in the world on each side where you know, people actually will buy tickets to watch them. So there's a lot of suspicion there about people getting tipped off about when they're getting tested. So the athletes, in terms of getting around these tests, they can get a lot of help.
Well, and talk about Russia specifically, how it upped its number of medals from Vancouver to Sochi. I mean, I was reading there's usually a bump in home country's performance, but I think they went from 3 gold medals in Vancouver 4 years before to 12 gold medals in Sochi, right?
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. 3 to 12 when the overall medals was 15 to 33. I came under a certain amount of embarrassment because I'm usually pretty good at predicting the number of medals that each country is going to get. And I really blew the Sochi games because I did not see Russia going from 3 to 12 and something like 15 to 33 in the overall count. And wouldn't you know it, I forgot to factor in the fact that, you know, they've been controlling all their own testing and they're controlling the labs and things like that for a couple of years. Had I been smarter, I would have taken that into account. When you have a home country games, you often do much better because you put a lot of money into developing athletes so your athletes can do well. That's very common. You have 7 years of getting ready for the games, so you really have an opportunity to raise athletes. What we've seen in Russia is when they host competitions, and you saw this in Moscow when they hosted the World Track and Field Championships as well, they do much better when they're hosting things than they do when the games are out.
And according to this independent inquiry said that, just as you say, that the Russians were controlling, or alleging that the Russians were controlling the doping lab. Here's Suzanne in Milton, Vermont. Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
I just have a quick comment.
Yes.
I'm just joining in, and I apologize if you've mentioned this before, but to me, competitive sports is all about pushing the limits of human performance. So health of the athletes, of course, is important, and cheating is an important issue, yes. But to me, it should be all about just natural performance and ability.
And doing it yourself. Suzanne, thank you. Here's Ron in Lago Vista, Texas. Hi, Ron. Welcome to On Point.
Howdy. I'm a coach for archery, USA Archery, and part of the conversation that isn't being held right now concerns USADA and the nature of the athletes, many of whom are not able to afford much. And some of your talkers or callers have talked about just letting the athletes do the drugs. And we're talking in many cases about minors who start at an age of 8 or 10 or 12, and they may have to commit to USADA as part of the testing pool to tell them in advance, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, exactly where they're going to be. One athlete I have in my family was tested up to 8 times a year as a Paralympian, and she didn't have a life. But to talk about this subject without bringing USADA and the policies that apply in the United States leaves a perspective out for everyone who's listening to understand just what the commitment is to these for these athletes to the sport at which they wish to excel.
Ron, thank you. USADA being the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Matt Futterman, speak to that. Are standards different here? I mean, we've certainly had our problems in the United States, no question about it.
Yes, standards are. I think standards are different here, where the U.S. now has a pretty good reputation for having a very intense drug testing program. A lot of that credit goes to Travis Tigert, who runs USADA. You know, you talk to athletes, they get knocks on their door at 6 in the morning, often, because that's when they're there. They get them at inconvenient times. I remember, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, when Meb Keflezighi had, you know, had a bad night's sleep and flown from California to New York for the New York Marathon, was thrilled to get to bed, had been sleeping for about an hour, and there was a knock on his door. That's a drag, you know. But that's what you subject yourself to in the U.S. It's called whereabouts test. Whereabouts testing. You have to log into a computer, or you can do it on your phone, and always tell them where you are. And if you are out of touch or you're not where you say you are, then you get in trouble for it. It actually counts as sort of a failed test. And if it happens 3 times, it's a fully failed test.
One last piece of sound here. In 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul, South Korea, Jamaican-born Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson wowed the world with his incredible speed and power as he zoomed past the U.S.'s Carl Lewis and broke the 100-meter world record. He was caught doping, and his gold medal was rescinded, handed over to Carl Lewis. Here is the sound of that short, incredible race.
It's a fair start, and it is Raymond Durr with a start, it is Ben Johnson with a start. Can Carl catch him? No! It's Ben Johnson! Ben Johnson does it again! Unbelievable! 9-7-9!
Absolutely incredible!
So in our last minute here, John Hoberman, what's next? How do you create a credible authority that can rein this all in? Is there a model that's ever worked? I'm thinking of the reconstruction of the Cycling Association after Lance Armstrong, for example. I mean, what do you see on the horizon after this Russia scandal?
Well, there's nothing harder than global governance, whether it's CO2 emissions or fish stocks in the oceans or anything else. In this case, you're trying to govern a population of thousands of elite athletes who are, as Matt pointed out, are going to have to, in effect, enter into a surveillance arrangement. It's a strict surveillance arrangement. It's an oppressive surveillance arrangement, and yet many of them are willing to do it. The problem here is that there is no transnational authority available to clean up this mess. The Secretary General of the UN can't do it. The Pope can't do it. So what happens is that national bodies, such as in the case of FIFA, it's the U.S. Department of Justice. In the case of the IAAF president who's in trouble, it's the French financial prosecutor. We don't know at this point whether a supra-transnational authority is going to be able to exert global governance that actually works.
What a story. John Hoberman, historian of the Olympics at the University of Texas at Austin. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Natalia Antonova, writer and former editor of the Moscow News. Natalia, thank you so much for sharing your perspective there from Moscow. And Matt Fetterman, senior special writer on sports for the Wall Street Journal. Matt, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.